All across America and around the world, you're listening to the Voice of America's Veterans, Veterans Radio. And here is today's host, the old slick pilot himself, known to his fellow pilots as T-Berry, Dale Thronberry.
Good morning, Gary, and welcome to Veterans Radio, everybody out there. We're having a really unusual situation going on today. I am get to be the host, and it looks like I'm trying to run the board at the same time, so it should be a real adventure.
Stand by for some excitement.
Yeah, there should be some excitement. If I start yelling incoming, you guys are going to know that I messed up something really serious here. But no, we're very excited to have you joining us here on Veterans Radio again from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're going to be talking with Mark Yablanka today about his book. We're very excited to have Mark back on our program. His book is called Distant War, and Mark was a reporter for Stars and Stripes, Vietnam Magazine, and a lot of other things. And over the last 20 years or 30 years or so, he's collected up these articles, and now he's put them all together in this book. And I think you're going to find it really interesting today when we talk to Mark about what's going on in his book. And I'm excited to talk to him because I think you'll find it. It'll bring back some really good memories and probably some that might upset you a little bit, but it's all right. We're here to help. So what's going on in the world, Gary? I know there's a number of things that we wanted to talk about.
Well, first, this past week was just incredible for some good friends and just good people. Don Beam and Tom Devine were honored over at the University of Michigan for the work that they do in helping the returning troops that are having issues with PTSD, and also to just greet the troops and tell them what to expect and how to reintegrate into society. They were honored with a lecture being given by Jonathan Shea, author of Achilles in Vietnam and
Odysseus in America.
Thank you.
he's been on our program. He is really one of the gurus or real leaders in the study of PTSD. He worked at the Boston VA for, I think he said, around 20 years.
He did, and he's also done consulting, apparently, for the Pentagon. And he's talked to just, thousands of veterans and doing the studies that are one of the things that I found really fascinating at in his lecture that, was given in their honor was that what sleep deprivation will do. And he was basically talking to the commanders. There were two generals there who were there to present these awards to Don and to Tom, the highest civilian awards that can be presented to civilians for the work that they do for the military. And basically he talked about how sleep deprivation doesn't reduce, say, the ability to fire a weapon for a soldier, but it reduces their ability to differentiate friend from foe, from neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty fan. And basically, he was talking to the commanders that you got to let these guys get more sleep. Otherwise, bad things are going to happen.
The other thing I found really fascinating, and I never even thought about this, we have a lot of friends our age, and I won't give our age, but all of you can guess it out there. It's
high 60s.
Plus or 100 minus. A lot of our friends are starting to suffer from old age diseases. Things, not just diabetes, but right. Parkinson's and some other things, and even Alzheimer's.
Right.
And one of the things that Dr. Shea pointed out is that when you have been traumatized or you've been in war, that they have found that it not only does it affect you emotionally, but it ages you physically.
I can appreciate that.
Right. And that it is starting to show up in the Vietnam era veterans, that they're suffering from old, I don't want to say old people's diseases, but I guess that's what it is,
sure.
at a higher rate than the general population.
I didn't hear him talking about that. That was probably at the
morning thing. We were Gary and I kind of split the day. He was here for two presentations. One was for the doctor's rounds, I guess you could say, at the University of Michigan Psychiatric Center. And then in the afternoon, he did a public talk, and Gary went. You went to the afternoon one. I went to the morning one. There were all kinds of doctors and shrinks around, and they all looked. It was very interesting.
Did they all look familiar?
No,
I only knew about half of them myself.
One did, but the other, some of them didn't. But there was an interesting question there, and one of the young psychiatrists, a young lady, asked a question that so many veterans are, one of the problems that they have is they feel betrayed. They have difficulty trusting people.
Yeah.
And she said she was not aware of troops feeling that they had been betrayed by higher-ups, you know, like their COs or generals or presidents or whatever it is. And the rest of the crew, the people there just kind of said, oh, yeah, that's a big thing. That, you know, the hardest thing to get through to a veteran when you're when they're going for help is to get them to trust you.
Right.
And yeah. We
I can relate to that.
We can both relate to
yes.
that.
What you said, though, is something that I was thinking about a couple of weeks ago. My gosh, there's more and more Vietnam vets I know that are starting to suffer from Parkinson's and probably early onset Alzheimer's. But I didn't hear Jonathan Shea say that. It was just something that I was all of a sudden sank into me a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a comment that he threw out, and I kind of just my eyes just popped open because I'm going, this is related. We're going to be hoping that we're going to be doing a program on PTSD and also with Tom and Don in the next couple of weeks. And so we want to get your questions ready because we want to help you people out there kind of figure out what's going on in your veteran's mind, whether it's you or it's a family member or something along those lines. We really want to try and do a program that's going to help people understand that.
I want to throw out one thing that Tom said. It was at the meeting or the panel discussion the day prior at Eastern Michigan University put on. I think it was just coincidental in time.
Yeah, it was a big PTSD week.
It really was. And Tom and Don were both there sitting in the front row just as, in, not as participants, but as guests like the rest of us. And somebody brought up the comment about veterans that have been to war being dangerous. And I didn't hear exactly how it was worded, but Tom jumped up and he said, "Let me handle that one. I was a sniper in Vietnam, and you know, I haven't had the urge to kill anybody since I came back." And basically his point was is when you've been to war, that's the last thing you want to do is hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's almost an urban myth, in my opinion, because, yes, it has happened. But, you know, when you've got a couple percent of the population being war veterans and you compare that to how many people have done things like this, that's, you know, it's so low a percentage that it's way out of proportion to how many have done it as opposed to how
right.
many
how many were just all military. And you got to remember that, you know, we veterans are just the same as everybody else out there. We all have our foibles and our problems and so forth, and sometimes they're exacerbated by our, you know, our experiences. But, you know, we don't go around doing that. And we've said this many times on our show. There is no organization out there called Veterans for War.
Yes,
you're going to find that veterans are more apt. They're probably going to be a little bit more conservative, but they also don't want to get involved unless there's a really good reason for it.
There's nobody more opposed to war than veterans. Doesn't mean that veterans are protesters. It's just
right.
that we don't like war.
No, we don't, because we've seen what it can do.
Right.
But speaking of veterans and veterans that survive wars and so forth, is Gary, we're going to have you do the welcome home today.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to do it. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of our country. We do this to let them know that we honor their service and their commitment to our country. Dateline Hawaii. Governor of Hawaii and its residents welcome home soldiers from the Hawaii Army National Guard's 29th Infantry Brigade Combat Team last week, following an eight-month deployment to Kuwait and Iraq. You know, some of these units are so hard to get out the whole thing.
I know. I don't know where they come up with all these names.
I don't either. Governor Lingle, Commander-in-Chief of the Hawaii National Guard, was on hand to welcome two planes of arriving soldiers. She joined hundreds of family members, friends, and colleagues in the anticipation and excitement of seeing the men and women return. The soldiers were mobilized on active duty for the past year. They spent several months training at Fort Hood, Texas, before deploying to Kuwait, where they were responsible for the security and administration of several military posts. Their mission also included escorting convoys into and out of Iraq. Dateline Fort Riley, Kansas. Families and friends welcomed home the Dagger Brigade last week. About 1,000 soldiers from the 2nd Heavy Brigade Combat Team returned in four groups following a one-year deployment to Baghdad, Iraq. With the redeployment of these soldiers, almost one-third of the 2nd Heavy Brigade Combat Team have returned from Iraq. About 3,800 soldiers with the Brigade deployed to Iraq from Fort Riley in September 2008, where they conducted security and stability operations. As a part of the Welcome Home festivities, the Brigade provided live video updates to family members beginning 3 hours prior to the arrival of the soldiers. Welcome home, you guys. Now, this one is pretty touching. It's about the Pride and Honor flights. I'm going to read it the way it was written. One by one, the men walked through the Columbus Metropolitan Airport terminal late Tuesday night. People to the left, people to the right, heroes in the middle. 96 World War II veterans returned home from a day-long West Georgia honor flight trip to Washington to visit the World War II Memorial in Arlington National Cemetery. More than 1,400 people, many family and friends, jammed the airport to welcome them home. These veterans fought in one of the most important wars in American history, said Army Lieutenant Colonel George Shahab von Hilsheimer, who was there in uniform to pay his respects. They sacrificed almost everything for this country. They represent citizen soldiers. They did what they had to do, then they came home and lived their lives. Columbus Juvenile Court Judge Aaron Cohn, now 93, who served in George Patton's army, led them off the plane and into the cheering crowd. Oh my gosh, Cohn said as people shook his hand and hugged his neck. I'm overwhelmed. As the veterans walked the long greeting line, the North Side High School marching band played God Bless America. Band director Tim Zabel, who called the homecoming a special thing, and said he was using the experience as a teaching moment for his students. I want my kids to realize that they are so fortunate to be able to say what they want and have people that want to defend this country, Zabel said. We were born into this country by the luck of the draw. He had been talking to his students about the importance of this event. This is not just another community gig, he said. Olivia and Lauren McLemore of Smith's were there to meet their great-grandfather, Kellen Shepherd. They held a big sign that read, Welcome Home, Kellen. The experience has been a life lesson for them, said Lauren, an eighth grader at Wacoochee Junior High. Her great-grandfather was a Navy photographer. He showed me some of his pictures, she said. One thing struck her about him. He was so handsome, she said. Columbus investment broker Dick Stone was not there to see anyone in particular, but he came out anyway. People realize we owe these people a debt of gratitude, said Stone, whose father was a World War II veteran. And people realize they are dying 1,000 a day, and for some of these guys, this can't happen next year or in 2 years. Carly Culpepper, 6, was up past her bedtime to welcome home her grandfather, Raymond Smith, of Smith Station. She said she loves him because he gives me lots of hugs. Asked what she was going to do when she saw him, she said, hug him. For veterans like Navy veteran Hawk Hawkins, 83, of Lynette, Alabama, the hug was figurative. This tells me my time in the service wasn't wasted, he said. Welcome Home was sponsored by the Marine Scholar Fund of Ave Maria University. Visit them online at avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. On behalf of a grateful nation and all of us at Veterans Radio, welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
back on Veterans Radio on this fine, beautiful Saturday morning here in Michigan. And we're being joined right now by our guest, Mark Yablonka. And Mark, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
It's great to be with you, Dale, and with Gary as well.
It's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so grateful that you sent me the book. The book is called Distant War, Recollections of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
Right.
And it's a series of articles, and Mark, let me give you a little more background on Mark. Served as a public affairs officer, a CW02, as was I, with the 40th Infantry Division Support Brigade and Installation Support Group, California State Military Reserve, at the Joint Forces Training Base in Los Alamitos, California. My sister lived right next to it, between 2001 and 2008. And you also served with the SAR-L, is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct.
Unit of the Israeli Defense Forces. That's a whole other story. I think we need to get into that one.
Happy to.
Tell me how you put this book together. Some of the articles are great, and we'll talk about them as we go along.
Sure. Well, you know, it came to pass that I just decided to put, I had about 30 articles over about a 20-year period, and I just felt that they needed a new, I don't know if I want to say audience, but just a new direction, and it was about a year-long process of my doing a lot of re-editing, and the challenge for me, I think, was in tying these various stories together. So I set about writing as you've seen in the book, the anecdotes that preceded and in some cases the epilogues that came after, noted how the individual interviews came about. And I had a lot of guidance from people along the way, fellow, Vietnam writers and Vietnam veterans and people in the, American Authors Association, like Maria Edwards, and in the Military Writers Society of America, Joyce Faulkner, a lot of other people who steered me along the path of what it means to write a book, which this being my first book, was like going back to school for me, even though I'd been a journalist for some, 25 or 30 years.
Well, you have been to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos a number of times, haven't you?
Right. Not during the war, but after the war, on assignment for Pacific Stars and Stripes. Vietnam Magazine had a piece in Army Times. I was a contributing writer to American Veteran Magazine, which is the AmVets Group quarterly publication for some 14 years. So the quest for me, I think, became how can I, as someone who was not there during the war, best illustrate for people like me what it was to be in Vietnam, both on the front lines and behind the front lines, both in uniform and out of uniform.
Well, you obviously, you talk to a lot of people in the book, and you have little articles about each one. Let's start off with the photographer. There's a world famous picture of a young Vietnamese girl running down the road, looking like she's naked.
Right, and, Kim Phuc.
Right, and could you kind of give us a little bit of background on that picture? Because I know you talked to the photographer, and there's a little misunderstanding with that photograph.
Right. Well, I'm proud to call Nicky Yutt a friend of mine, and met him through others, other photojournalists who were in Vietnam several years ago, and had the honor of meeting Kim Phuc when she was out here in Los Angeles several years ago. And it's just one of those photos that I think in some ways, many people feel either shaped or categorized the Vietnam War, and there's both positive and negative feelings about that photo. I think as a photo itself speaks to the human spirit and that which war, I think, can affect all of us. It's an interesting history as to how that photo came about. It almost didn't make the pages of all the newspapers and magazines around the world when it came out because of the issue of frontal nudity.
Right.
But for the insistence of Photo Bureau Chief Horst Voss, one of the photojournalist who worked for the Associated Press in Vietnam for many years. That photo would have never seen the light of day.
Tell me a little bit more about the photographer. This is a very interesting story in and of itself.
Right. Nick was a young lad of, I think, 15 or 16 when his older brother, who had been an Associated Press photographer and a very famous actor in Vietnam, was killed covering a skirmish between the VC, the Viet Cong, and ARVN, Army of the Republic of Vietnam soldiers. And when, Associated Press staffers came to his wife, Arlette, and told her of the news of Nick's eldest brother's death, among the sadness, that also left the family without a breadwinner. And so Nicky went to work for the Associated Press, but they wouldn't let him out of the darkroom, and for fear that if he were to perish in the Vietnam War, the family would be, which was a much beloved family, both, you know, at the offices of the Associated Press there in Saigon and all over Vietnam and amongst AP staffers, that there would be, you know, no one to be a breadwinner in the family. Little by little, he was able to venture out into the, into the field, so to speak, and at the urging of people like Peter Arnett, who was also an AP correspondent who, as we all know, later went to work for CNN, kind of graduated into the streets of Saigon and then later onto the battlefield, and Nick became a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer with that photo. A sweeter, gentler person you will never meet, and it's kind of, I suppose a chuckle of a story, a sidelight that when the Vietnam War ended, the AP got Nick out of there, put him up in a hotel out here in Hollywood, and he was so unused to the lifestyle here in California, where I'm coming to you from, he demanded to go, right away to the tent city that had been erected for the Vietnamese refugees down at Camp Pendleton, south of here, just to be with his people, and lived out of the tents for some time until all those folks were resettled into the United States and sponsored.
I think that's an unusual aside, that most of us were not aware that there was a tent city set up outside of Camp Pendleton to take the people that we got out first when Saigon fell.
Right, on April 30th of 75, yes. Right.
And then also that they were joined subsequently by the boat people.
Right, a couple years later.
And isn't that how this young girl got out? How did she get out?
Well, she didn't basically get out. She became, I suppose you could say, a poster child for the communist point of view. As you're well aware, mm-hmm. April 30th, 75, Saigon fell, and for all intents and purposes, we were, the American military effort had ceased in Vietnam, and Kim did not get out. Nick's photo, of course, remained an icon all over the world. Kim was at one point sent to Cuba, in fact, and when I met her, I overheard her speaking fluent Spanish, which I thought was very interesting, Spanish that she had learned while she was in pharmacy school in Cuba. At one point in time, she married a fellow pharmacy student that she met in Cuba, and I guess for the Vietnamese in country, there were only, a select few places that they were allowed to honeymoon, one of them being the Soviet Union. And coming back from their honeymoon, they just silently slipped off the plane when it was refueling. I think it was in Gander, Newfoundland. Left all their luggage on board, declared themselves, and sought, I should say, political asylum in Canada. And to this day, Kim and her husband and their children live happily in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
I think that's a great story. I really admire these people that did that. Let's move along to something a little bit more lighthearted, and that would be the Wheel of Fortune.
Pat Sajak.
Let's talk a little bit about Pat Sajak. Most
people
don't know that he was on Armed Forces Radio in Vietnam.
That's right. He was along with the likes of the well-known Adrian Cronauer, one of those morning men who every morning at 0600, you know, basically leaned into the mic and said, "Good morning, Vietnam." You know?
And I did that the very first show that we did. I've always wanted to do it, so. And then I said, "Well, that's enough of that."
By the way, it wasn't such an easy, mission for Pat to get connected with, in his words, and I kind of found them quite funny. Now, when he joined the Army, he came into the Army, a disc jockey of some notoriety, having been on the air in Chicago, and in his words, the Army did what it
does best.
what it knew how to do best. It made him a desk clerk in Long Bend. And I think it took four letters, including one to his congressman, who coincidentally had been the owner of the first radio station he'd worked for in Chicago, that was by night a Polish language station, to get the Army to wake up and transfer Pat from his desk job, at which many of the people he shuffled papers for told him he did a great job, and it still means a lot to him today, by the way, mm-hmm. but it took that letter from his congressman to get him, behind the mic at AFVN.
Gary, you had a question?
Yes, I heard Pat Sajak tell a story a couple of months ago about the Christmas Eve broadcast, which would have been, I guess, Christmas morning in Vietnam. Did you ever hear that story from him about the president's address?
No, I did not, Gary, but I'd love to.
You're about to hear it, and it is funny. He was addressing the Vietnam Veterans of America National Convention, and he was told that the president was going to address the nation, and so at a certain time he was to click off from his rock and roll format to the president's address. And so he did so, and President Nixon spoke to the nation. When he was done, Pat turned it off and went to a rock and roll number, and in his earphones he heard the president then start to address the troops in Vietnam personally. And he thought, oh my gosh, and instantly he did the quick evaluation. Do I go back to the president's address and let everybody know that I screwed up? And then he thought, I'm the only person in the world that knows this. So he just left it off and he continued on with his rock and roll number. And the president finished and he just kept on going. And he said, so all of you who served in Vietnam in Christmas of 1969, Merry Christmas from President Nixon.
That is a great story.
Well, I can tell you, the AFVN saved my life more often than not, because in our helicopters we had an ADF, automatic direction finder, which we would always have tuned into Armed Forces Radio, at least down in 3 Corps in Saigon. So we always knew where we were in relationship to Saigon. So if we got lost out in the jungle someplace, we would always turn around and start heading normally south. So it's greatly appreciated. We got about a minute until our first break, Mark.
Sure.
And I wanted you to talk a little bit. There's an interesting story in here real quickly about a woman named Catherine Leroy.
Right.
Who was French?
Yes, she was a French photojournalist who basically hadn't had much, experience in photojournalism other than photographing her cat around her apartment when she just up and decided to, I think she had $100 in her pocket, and a Leica camera, and a one-way ticket to Saigon. She figured if I was going to learn my craft, I better do it in a war. And she became one of the most renowned of the, civilian photojournalists to cover the war. Her photos ended up in Life and Look magazines. And I know you're running
I was just interested. I just thought she was a rather fascinating person.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And if you have time on the other side, maybe we can talk about her jump with the 173rd Airborne.
That's right. Yes. Let's do that. We'll be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
This is one of them. Sergeant Lester Stone, despite being exposed, continued to provide cover for a wounded soldier being rescued. Details after this.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Stone was on a combat patrol mission when it came under intense automatic weapons and grenade fire from a well-concealed company-sized force of North Vietnamese regulars. Observing the platoon machine gunner fall critically wounded, Stone remained in the exposed area to provide cover fire. With enemy fire impacting all around him, Stone had a malfunction in the machine gun, preventing him from firing the weapon automatically. Stone repaired the weapon and continued to place effective suppressive fire on the enemy positions, which enabled the rescue to be completed. In a desperate attempt to overrun his position, an enemy force left its cover and charged Stone. Disregarding the danger involved, Stone rose to his knees and began placing intense fire on the enemy at point-blank range, killing six of the enemy before falling mortally wounded. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.